I'm a little bit like a dog chasing my tail. I just kind of go where my creativity takes me.
From the Coin Podcast Network studios in Portland, Oregon, this is Six Questions with Emily Burris and Ian Costello.
Emily joining us live to tape from somewhere in Portland in a condo via Zoom today.
My dog Samwise wants to join our Zoom call and say hello.
Hi Sam.
Yes, I am. I am Zooming at home. Took a day here at home after Samwise had a bit of a tough night last night, which means that both of us had a tough night last night. And it's really hard to start your day at 3 a.m. when the previous day just hasn't really ended. So he and I are both taking some time at home today to catch up on a few things. So I do not have the fancy microphone in front of me today. Anytime he can tell, I'm sure there's a lot of people at home who have also had pandemic pets who can tell now, you know, the second you get on a call or a work call or a conference or anything, and they make it their life's work to interrupt you because they are no longer the center of your attention.
And thanks to the last 2 years, we've been using Zoom to do a lot of things that we had not thought of we would be able to use Zoom to do beforehand.
Yeah, Zoom has become a part of my vocabulary that was not here beforehand. So,
and with that, happy Friday morning.
It's been a busy week.
It has been a busy week. Our conglomeration of news over the last several days hasn't been overly fun.
No, it has not. Lots of things happening. And it feels like, I don't know, it feels like everything is just speeding back up again. I felt like we got a little break from this over the summer where 2021, like there was what looks like this light at the end of the tunnel. And and now for several reasons, it just feels like we're getting back into that 2020, like drinking from a fire hose of there being a new global problem every week, in addition to the current ongoing, never ending global problem of a pandemic.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
Because it's been such a busy week, that's been a little funky, even in terms of getting this part recorded. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do with your weekend?
Oh boy. So I'm actually flying out to Maryland to see my grandfather for his 90th birthday.
90th birthday. That's a big birthday.
Yeah. Everyone in the family is now vaccinated. And obviously we started making plans for all of this earlier this summer before the Delta variant was doing what it's doing now. But we're trying to do a little outdoor dinner and get together. And that'll be the first time in over 2 years that I've gotten to see him. So what are you doing with your weekend?
It's finally time for us to go camping.
There you go.
Looking forward to sitting somewhere and not doing anything. I also realized that sitting somewhere and not doing anything may have been the camping trips of the past. I'm wondering, when I'm trying to keep a 14 and a half month old from eating dirt or falling in a campfire or crawling herself into the ocean, it's going to be a little bit busier than my old camping trips used to be, but all of life is a little bit busier.
Probably. Maybe a few less beers by the fire or stuff like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's some lessons out there. I can remember going camping with my parents and learning things about falling down and being dirty and sleeping outside, which will be a new experience for her.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's interesting that you bring up, lessons learned from generation to generation, because that's exactly what we're talking about on this week's podcast.
It's an interesting listen.
Yeah.
The biggest things can sometimes come out of the smallest ideas. And here's this story of someone who is just trying to figure out a way to communicate with his own kids.
Yeah.
And these things just keep happening.
Absolutely. It's very cool. So this week I sat down with Jelani Memory. He is a husband, father, and the founder of a kids company About, which is now a huge company. They've raised millions of dollars to help facilitate and foster conversations with the next generation on lots of different platforms, over podcasts, in digital media, in print media. And this all started with something that people are probably familiar with here in Portland. You've probably heard about it before, a kid's book about. So this was his idea. He's gotten a lot of attention for this book that he put together, a kid's book about racism, as a way for him to talk with his kids in his family. He's part of a blended family and has white children, brown children, mixed race children, and a way to have some of these conversations, because he knew that it was a need coming up in his life that he knew he was going to have to talk with his kids about. And his idea and what has worked well for his family has become a tool for countless other families to now start having some of these conversations and changing the conversation for the next generation and how we communicate with our kids.
And it started with this kid's book about racism. But as you'll hear in the conversation, it has evolved to basically a kid's book about fill in the blank with mm-hmm. any difficult topic. Mm-hmm. To hear him talking about other issues, whether it be therapy, whether it be sexual identity, whether it be race relations, he's addressing so many things that in my generation, your generation, kind of our generation, our parents talk to us about it a little bit more than their parents talk to them about it. And our great-grandparents talk to our grandparents about it. Mm-hmm. It still was largely unsaid.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I think about the therapy angle, and I was going to therapy when I was a little kid to deal with some things that my mom was going through. And I was the weird one. Mm. I was embarrassed to talk about that with my friends. It still kind of makes me embarrassed because it just wasn't talked about. And here's this guy, again, this simple idea of, man, I need to figure out a way to talk to my own kids about something difficult, opened up this, whatever the opposite of a can of worms is, opened up this can of greatness to really, really help launch and guide these very difficult conversations.
Parents these days are probably dealing with more than ever before, you know, everything that life has thrown at us, certainly in the last few years, and just the pace of life and how much is available to everyone on the internet and how global, you know, this world has become. So I hope that anyone out there who's in the thick of all the back to school craziness and everything getting busy this fall will just take a few minutes here, enjoy my conversation with Jelani, and use it to help have those conversations in your life. First off, thanks for taking the time to chat with me today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I know you are quite a busy guy right now. Lots of new and exciting things for you, which we're going to get to in just a moment. But first, I just want to give people the chance to kind of get to know you. So tell me a little bit about yourself. Sure. I know that's a horribly open-ended question.
No, that's okay. Born and raised in Portland, Oregon. I love this city. I've been able to watch it grow, change, and come into its own, I suppose. And there's really nowhere else in the world I'd rather live. I'm a father to 6 kids, 4 stepkids, 2 bio kids, and have a blended family with mixed race kids and white kids. I like to say that I was a born entrepreneur, mostly because I'm not sure I could do anything else. Not really a great employee, but I love creating things from nothing and using my creativity to make products that really are meaningful and matter to folks.
That's fantastic. No, that's a great place to start. You mentioned that you're an entrepreneur, and I know that a lot of your recent projects, you know, we have talked with you here at Coin News before about, but what did you kind of first get started in? Tell me about some of your first ventures as an entrepreneur.
You know, I could take it all the way back to high school. Back in high school, I would sell artwork. Gosh, I could even, you know, I would sell artwork to my classmates in middle school and elementary school, but, you know, in terms of seriously considering a career in art, there was always commerce mixed in there with me. I wanted to not just make good art, I wanted to make money off of it. And so I remember doing hand-drawn logo designs in high school. I remember selling some portraiture that I did. And so those are the earliest days of me sort of machinating on entrepreneurship. I didn't have a word for it then, but that's really what it was. And then when I got to college, my very first job was, and again, you know, entrepreneurship just sort of born into me, was doing private basketball lessons. It was sort of this job that I invented for myself. I found families that would pay me money on an hourly basis to train their kids to be better at hoops.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, really embedded into a lot of stuff that I did early on. You know, one of the fun things that I did, like I'm not extroverted. I'm not even relatively funny. But my sophomore year of college, I started an improv comedy troupe. And to me, it made the most sense in the world. It was like, oh, I have a great idea. I just need to assemble a group of people and give them vision and lead them. And then they'll be funny and they'll do all those things. And I had a blast.
So you didn't necessarily want to be the improv comic. You were just like, I can organize all of this and make it happen.
That's exactly it. And actually, I would host the shows. And again, like I'm a halfway decent public speaker, but my thing is not to be up in front of people and be funny. But the organizational aspect of bringing a group of people together to be sort of larger than the sum of their parts, that was so obvious and ingrained in my sort of innate skill set that, it didn't bring any cause for nervousness or fear or what if this fails. It was just so much fun, which then leads to, you know, when I finished college, a career in photography and then eventually filmmaking, just getting to sort of, you know, bring a whole different set of skills, but those same entrepreneurial skills, making something that matters, it's creative, and then hopefully making some money off of that.
That's so interesting. And very cool that you've been able to kind of like pave your own way in all different areas. I mean, even with something like basketball, I mean, was basketball your main activity in school? Were you always really into sports?
Yeah, it was really art and sports growing up, grade school, middle school, high school. And by the time I get to high school, you know, I was playing three varsity sports, soccer, basketball, and track. And yet still pursuing this track around being an artist when I grew up, which was really my sort of original dream and hope as a 6 year old. But sports was, you know, you practice 5 times a week, 2 hours at a time, you know, we play it year round, do 3 sports. So that ate up a lot of my time. And there was this massive vacuum when I got to my sophomore year of college, because I'd finally stopped playing sports for the first time in my life. And I realized, oh my gosh, there's so much time to do other things. And I got really excited because I got to fill in that gap with all these new ventures.
I was also a high school athlete, never wanting to take it beyond that. I knew my limits, but I think I kind of hit the same bump where you get to college and you're like, okay, that's no longer one of my focuses, because at that level, it has to kind of either be your main focus or you got to go do something else. And I remember kind of finding myself wondering, like, I've always just been good at school because school was what I did. Mm. And the goal was always to get to the next grade. And then you kind of get to this jumping off point. It's like, but what do you want to do with your life? Mm-hmm. And that becomes kind of the point at which I'm like, well, I don't know. I don't know where I go from here. Especially being someone who, you know, wanted to kind of go their own way and blaze their own trail. How did you navigate that?
You know, for me, it was really simple. It was, I want to do it all. So why not? It was very easy for me to say yes and try things and not have all of them work out. I mean, the littered bodies of failed projects is a mile long, but every one of them, I learned something from, I had fun trying. It was worth a test. And, you know, out of every 10 projects, there's one that just sort of works and clicks and goes, and then you end up spending all your time on that. Mm. And in some sense, all of my companies are, you know, are the fruition of trying things and failing things until they eventually work. So it, to me, it was actually a really easy equation of, you know, for someone who wants to pave their own way, it was, oh, let's just start trying things and see what works. And I really take from sports my fear of failure, or my lack of fear of failure, in terms of when you go play a basketball game or a soccer game, you lose, it sucks, it's hard, but then you move on and you play another game and you play another game and mm-hmm. another game. And you start mm-hmm. to forget, you know, sort of whether you won or lost or which games those were. You just start to have this culminating skill set as well as enjoyment of the thing you're doing. And that for me, that was entrepreneurship and ultimately my career or careers professionally.
Yeah, it's like the more games you play, the less you know, life-ending importance you put on every single one, right? You learn that there's always another.
That's exactly
there's
it.
Always another opportunity. Yeah. Well, I know, you know, one of the, I think, big opportunities that came your way was, or that, you know, that you've really created for yourself was, first off, this venture into this software company called Circle. So I'm curious kind of how that got off the ground and got started. And then I think the other thing that might be a little more familiar to most people who are listening to this podcast would be the book series that you created, a kid's book about. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have probably heard about a kid's book about racism, a kid's book about feminism, all these big topics. So talk to me about kind of both of these ventures and how they came about.
Sure. Well, let's start with Circle. Blood, sweat, and tears, and a lot of fun, to be honest. I was fulfilling my dream, doing a career in photography and filmmaking, doing commercial projects for the likes of Nike, Reebok, you name it, getting to do some interesting sports portraiture kind of stuff. So using my background in sports, but applying that sort of creative muscle. And a friend of mine was like, let's start a company. I think there's really a big problem to solve when it comes to kids and their digital lives. He's like, you know, there's no way for me to parent my kids in that space, but I want to be a good parent. I don't want to be overbearing. He's like, right. I don't want to install this onerous software that just is like, says they can't do a 500,000 things. He's like, I just want to be able to parent them. And so, you know, he became the business. I became the creative, and we brought on a third co-founder to be the technical. It took us a couple years, almost 2.5 years to really get it off the ground, and through many fits and starts. And that's where I sort of learned, how hard entrepreneurship really is, but how much fun that hard part is, mm-hmm. is that it requires so much resilience, so much grit, so much vision, and then follow through, right? Execution. So eventually we, you know, quite luckily score a partnership with the Walt Disney Company. We raise $1 million, a handful of weeks after that, and are off to the races 4 months later, launching to the market, as Circle with Disney. Now again, blood, sweat, and tears. So there's a lot of things that came before and after that, but, it was me learning, coming from photography and filmmaking, how do you launch a product? How do you go to market? How do you build a brand? And I was just like a kid in a candy store, learning all those bits and pieces of how to tell those stories. And ultimately we grow that company up. We raise, you know, we fill out the rest of our seed round. We raise a Series A, a Series B, and partner with the likes of the Walt Disney Company and T-Mobile and Sky in the UK and Netgear. And reach genuinely millions of kids all over the world with what we think and thought then was a better way to sort of manage your digital life. And now it's kind of cool. Fantastic. To see Apple and Google and all these other companies have built very similar software, I say, eerily similar, but offer it to all of their customers. And for us, it was never about let's make $1 zillion. It was about how do we make it so that kids get a really great relationship with the technology in their lives and not a terrible one? And so glad to see more companies doing it.
Well, they say that that's like one of the keys to successful entrepreneurship, right? Is to identify a need and work to fill it. And it seems like you guys were right there identifying that need even before it became kind of more of a mainstream concern for a lot of those big tech companies.
That's it. And I'll go even further. You know, entrepreneurship is really about solving your own problems, right? Having such an acute awareness of what the issues are with something in your life. And that ultimately ends up making you far more qualified to solve that problem because you very intimately feel the pain points of that problem. So, like I said, we raise a bunch of money, we grow up the company, and in the summer of 2018, I won't quite say I take a break because we were more busy than ever at Circle, but I decided to write a kid's book for my own children. You know, by that time, my wife and I had been married for a handful of years, blended our two families, we've got a new kid on the way. And I feel it impressed upon me that my kids feel comfortable talking with me about racism specifically. Having white kids as a Black dad means that that conversation has to be open. And it was one that I was already having with my brown kid at the time, and my soon to be brown kid who's now three. So, you know, not quite having the conversation, but it'll come. So I wrote a kid's book about racism. Only printed one copy. I wrote it and designed it in a couple of weeks. And it was like not supposed to be a big thing, a big deal, a big project.
Oh, really?
It was a thing I did for my kids, genuinely. And so I get the copy that October in the mail, and my kids like it. They think it's cool, and something sort of magical happens. And I go back to this as a sort of very clear light bulb moment. My kids were the first ones that saw that you could make a series of books out of my book on other topics. They were like, you could make a kid's book about divorce, Dad. And I was like, yeah, I suppose I could.
Wow.
And that was for my kids, you know, 9 and 10 at the time. And when I showed it to other grownups, they had the exact same response. But one further, and this was something that my kids did as well, they would open up a part of their life with me. Something about having a kid's book about racism, that me going to that very vulnerable place with my kids, allowed them to talk about their struggles with mental health, losing a parent to cancer, you name it. Those other vulnerable spots in our lives that are hard to talk about, me unlocking and revealing that part of myself allowed them to do the same. And look, once my kids gave me that idea and I started to sort of verify it, I suppose, with other adults, it just was so sticky. I couldn't let it go. And it was at the least opportune time, right? We were a rocket ship growing this big, cool tech company that, you know, I was really the mind behind the product. And yet this kid's book, I realized, it was new, it was novel, it was unique, and I wasn't sure anybody else was going to do not just my book at scale, but other books like it on hard to talk about subjects. So that was really the genesis of me going, what if there were a collection of kids' books, heck, kids' media, that treated kids like they were smart, that talked up to them, not down to them, and was on the most sort of taboo, uncomfortable, impossible to talk about conversation topics: death, cancer, gender, sexuality, feminism, emotions, empathy, gratitude, systemic racism, white privilege, you name it. And for the youngest of kids, we're talking 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Yeah.
So I left Circle to go start that company, and it's working out.
What did your family think at the time when you said, "Hey, I'm gonna go do this"?
You know, my wife knows I'm a little bit like a dog chasing my tail. I just kind of go where my creativity takes me, and she knew. She just could see the crazed look in my eye that I was gonna chase this no matter what. So she told me go for it. And we figured out the money and the job and all that stuff. You know, we figured that all out, but there was nothing but support from those around me.
So you get this sticky idea, you have to make this book series happen. And obviously you did, because it's been really well received, I think. What was kind of the initial reception as this idea kind of started to pick up steam?
First, it was me showing my book and sort of my idea to friends, to other entrepreneurs, to investors. Not quite pitching, but showing, you know, sort of a little bit of show and tell. And there was immediate sort of, traction, I suppose, to the idea. And that led me to getting our first 12 authors. That led me to creating a new way to make books. I think, we do this 1-day workshop method where we write all of our books in a single day workshop session. And then when we launched, I mean, this was the ultimate test of going, will parents, educators, grandmas, grandpas, aunties and uncles show up to get these books for kids in their lives? And they did. It was really incredible and phenomenal. And cheers to every sort of, you know, I don't know, 30 to 40 year old parent with 2.5 kids. It was like, you know, maybe we should talk to our kids about depression. Maybe because they have depression, or because I do, and I need to explain what it's like to go through it so they understand me, you know, or what it's like to be told that you're not creative, which is really what our creativity book tackles, or what is it like to have an anxiety disorder, not to just feel nervous, but to have anxiety, and just to go there with kids. So we started to sell, you know, thousands of books right away. And it was sort of off to the races from there.
It's one of those things that, you know, maybe in prior generations or even several years ago, I think, and for a lot of people today, still, there's probably this gut reaction of like, oh, we don't want to talk about that around the kids, right? Like, oh, let's, you know, those are, I know, like, I grew up in a family that didn't necessarily have some of those real tough conversations when I was younger, right? Why is it that you think we need to be having these conversations? And as you said, you know, not talking down to kids, talking up to them and presenting them with some of these really bigger ideas and quote unquote tough topics early on.
I'll give you three reasons. The first is they don't carry in all the baggage that we do as adults. They just don't, they don't have the preconceived notion that this is taboo or bad to talk about or uncomfortable. They're totally fine with it. The second thing is that adults, we grown ups, we proactively avoid these conversations because of our baggage, because of all the things we learned not to talk about, especially as adults with each other. And so when it came to kids, it was like, oh, well, of course you can't do that. And then the last bit is really the generational trauma, I'll call it, from having not been talked to as kids about this kind of stuff. You can point to any millennial parent and they will say the same thing about our books. I wish I had this when I was a kid, because our parents just didn't talk to us about it. And you know why? Because their parents didn't talk to them about it, and their parents didn't talk to them about it, right? It just goes back and back and back. And so we're the first generation of parents who's like putting our kids in therapy and not stigmatizing it. First generation of parents who are spending more time with our kids statistically, like actual engaged time with them. And we're the first ones that realize like, oh, you can really screw a kid up. They're not just sort of like, you know, you put food on the table 3 times a day and send them to school and then they're on their own. It's like, oh no, you can have a lasting impact on who they are. And so I also think we'll be the last generation of parents who say, I did the best I could, because we also know that maybe we're not, maybe actually we're kind of jacked up and need help on our own, you know, let alone helping our kids. And so I think that's why this is happening now. That's why these books are being received in this way now. I think because I'm the product of all these things that I to me, it was important to spearhead it. And here's the truth. As kids have always needed this. They've always needed these things. And maybe they've shown up in different ways at different times. You know, imagine being a six-year-old growing up during World War II, right? I'm sure parents had some conversations, right? So, but we're living in a time now where there's so many conversations to have, and there's an acute awareness, I think, by parents to go, my kid has a complex and real internal emotional thought life experience going on. I should probably engage with that. And I should probably offer them the respect that they're in the most formative years of their life. And that just telling them, I'll tell them when they're older, cannot possibly work.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're talking about what it's like growing up Black in a really white city.
The town of Detroit, it is almost completely burned out. There's one or two restaurants that have been saved. For all intents and purposes, this town is gone.
A year of fire
and ice
and heat.
116 Oregonians have now died as a result of the state's recent heat wave.
Three deadly weather events that made international headlines.
But what is the connection to climate change?
I think Mother Nature is very mad at humans.
Now, the COIN Podcast Network is going beyond the headlines.
The crises we're going to be facing from climate change are really going to balloon and intersect with other crises.
Deep into a discussion about our changing climate,
the danger it poses to all of us,
and what you can do about it.
We better start doing something about it real soon.
People are just not prepared for this.
It is a climate in crisis coming this September on the COIN Podcast Network.
Speaking of entrepreneurship, trying to solve your own problems, right? And these were conversations you needed to have in your own blended family. I'm curious too, you know, growing up in Portland as a Black man, what were some of the things that you've experienced in an overwhelmingly white city?
Yeah, double-edged sword for sure. One of the benefits I received was that, you know, my family, and specifically my mom, made sure that we were around other Black kids growing up, that we were within the Black community. And so that was basketball camps, that was cookouts, that was, you know, that was quite frequent. While we grew up in Southwest Portland, we'd often sort of make our way over to Northeast and North Portland, where most of the Black population in Portland is. And so I think that was a gift to make sure that I wasn't sort of cut off from an identity perspective from folks who looked like me.
Sure.
You know, the other side of it is being the only Black kid in just about every class, having one Black teacher from grade school, middle school, high school, and college.
Wow.
That leaves an impact on you.
Yeah.
You know, racism was the water that I swam in, so much so that you don't even recognize it as racism very often. And that's, you know, that's names, that's comments, all sorts of moments that now we know how to refer to them as microaggressions or as, you know, institutional racism, etc. And I think I began to form a language around it in middle school and especially high school, and then definitely college as I sort of came into my own around the appropriateness of some comments and the inappropriateness and pushing back and calling people out. What I found, and this was actually in college when I was like, okay, I'm surrounded by a bunch of really smart people. These are smart people. They're really loving and caring people. My friends, but they don't know what the hell they're talking about when it comes to race. And so I found myself needing to educate them to go, let me take you into my experience a little bit and help you understand it. An idea that's still prevalent, but was very much prevalent when I was in college was sort of this like, oh, well, I don't see color, Jelani. I just see a person. You're just a person.
Sure.
And even then I sort of knew inherently that sort of feels wrong. Right. And not having a fully sort of built out understanding around sort of the how problematic colorblindness is, then I was able to articulate sort of like, you know, it's okay to see me as a Black man. That's okay. So to fast forward to now, I'm quite thankful I've gotten to grow up here, to live here. I am also aware of how problematic many of the ideals and the communities here are in Portland around sort of seeming progressive and yet having this undercurrent of sort of, you know, colorblindness and institutionalized racism by essentially ignoring that race might exist at all, or believing that race was sort of, racism was a thing that happened way in the past, right? That was the Ku Klux Klan and slavery.
We ended slavery and fixed everything.
Martin Luther King said, "I have a dream." And all of a sudden, everybody was like, we agree with that, right?
Right. We're all good.
And the reality is that's just not true. Growing up here, again, thankful, but it was complicated. It was definitely complicated. And I still find it's complicated. I'm often one of the handful of Black people walking into a space, and folks actually find themselves very surprised when they interact with our company, especially since it's founded here in Portland and most of the employees are here in Portland. They're like, "You have Black people." It's like, yes, Black people exist in Portland. Actually, they've contributed quite a bit, and you can hire them. They have jobs too. We've just made a point at a kids company about to create a diverse team. And there's tons of really great diverse talent here in Portland, Oregon.
It's interesting. I mean, this book came out a couple years before the year that we just had in 2020, this, you know, racial reckoning, as it was, you know, kind of dubbed, the protests, the all these conversations and demonstrations that we've had over the better part of last year. I can only imagine for a lot of people, it has been stressful, tied in with the stress of the pandemic to kind of go through some of these experiences that are probably kind of re-traumatizing in a way, even if it's meant to push something forward. Mm-hmm. What has been your take on some of the events of the last year and a half and some of the conversations that we're still having? And the fact that it seems to be for many people, one of the first times that maybe they're paying attention to some of it.
I think there was a world before George Floyd's murder and there was a world after it. Much in the same way that you could talk about the civil rights movement. And look, I don't understand why he was not the only Black man murdered in cold blood and caught on camera. But if you add in the pandemic, if you add in the people at home sort of on edge, if you add in sort of the stacking up of these dead bodies and the loss of life and the sort of very obvious institutional racism, it just reached a breaking point. And one, I'm frustrated that it took so long, but thankful that a whole swath specifically of the United States of America is now trying to engage with what is racism? What does it mean? What's mm-hmm. my role in dismantling it and keeping it there and understanding it? And I think we're early days. I think we are early mm-hmm. days. The moment all the protests began, that wasn't sort of the end of it, that everything wasn't going to change in that moment, that it was going to be the start of a journey for many folks to start learning and then hopefully teaching their kids and their kids could teach their kids, right?
Right.
None of this is more typified than what I'd often hear from adults about my book was that it was very helpful for them and their understanding of racism. Mind you, my book is written for 5-year-olds. It's not meant to help any adult understand racism, and yet it was.
Right.
And it sort of taught me this is where most grownups are at who've never engaged with the idea of racism. They're at a kindergarten or first grade level. And so we need to speak to them in that way and start to grow them up in their knowledge and understanding. We can't just start them with, you know, raise a fist, show up to a protest and, you know, high concepts like, you know, anti-racism and, you know, defunding the police. I don't know. Right. Like it just,
sure.
That's not where they're at.
Right. Right.
They're trying to go, oh, it's okay to say somebody has Black skin. I mean, right. Like,
right. Right. Well, and I think that, you know, I think that might be kind of a source of a lot of the friction or the immediate pushback for a lot of people who bristle at mentions of defund the police or, you know, some of these flashpoint kind of, you know, phrases or topics and people are so quick to react with maybe not taking a step back first and understanding the nuance there and where that's coming from. I know that's one thing that, like, I can speak for me personally. Last year, I almost see it as like kind of just a full realization of the extent of my privilege, of the depth of my privilege in a way that I was not fully aware of before. That's such a it's a crazy thing to kind of take a step back and realize, like, I thought I understood, right?
Yeah.
And I did not. I thought I understood the ways in which I was a good person and I was moving through this world, you know, being a good member of society. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, fully starting to realize just the ways in which history has played a role in setting up different institutions and things that we go about our day to day and never just understand the way in which it benefits certain people and puts others at a disadvantage. And so I think there's just so much of that education that people who, you know, like me, grew up in a world where we don't see color and, you know, felt weird calling someone black. It was African American, right? And it's just all these things that you have to kind of things you learned in school and learning that what you learned in school maybe wasn't the whole picture. There's so much there. And so by starting those conversations at a younger age, you're teaching kids hopefully to think critically and, you know, not take certain things at face value or be willing to open up their understanding and let other perspectives in. That's such an important first step, it seems like.
Yeah. And you said two things. You know, one is education. And I think that applies just as much for adults as it does for kids. And then two is like that just getting kids started off on the right foot. And it turns out when we change the conversations we're having as adults, it changes the things that kids know and learn, right? Because when we grow up not talking about race, when we grow up not talking about racism, we institutionalize in kids' minds and understanding that those things are either don't exist or they're off limits, right? And then it takes them becoming an adult, which, by the way, it's not their fault if they're an adult and they're saying, oh, everyone, you know, I don't see color, everyone's equal, and we live in a fairyland where racism doesn't exist. That is actually not their fault. They never had a chance because all the adults around them, the very educational system that they were in, likely perpetuated these ideas and beliefs. And so it's no wonder they carried them into the world and then all of a sudden ran into somebody and somebody was like, well, that's not true. Like, that's wrong, right? and then like for them to join a broader conversation around race in America, at this moment, they're at a massive disadvantage because they're way behind. People of color have been having this conversation for a very long time. And so what often happens is that to certain individuals, it feels extreme. What do you mean? Mm-hmm. Racism is everywhere. I can't tell you how much I get accused of being racist for saying that racist things happen, which boggles the mind, one. But two, right.
Or the comment, like, why do you have to make everything about race?
Exactly. And the reality is because from the very founding of this country, there's a through line where it has been all about race from the very beginning. Us calling it out, right? Whether it's people of color or activists or allies, and saying it can't stay this way. You know, it was a myth that it was never about race, and it's a myth that it's still not about race, right? And so, to circle back, I am thankful for the conversations happening. I just hope it keeps going, that it keeps sort of moving forward. And then on the other side, I hope we're able to pinpoint and do away with the performative nature, I think, of some individuals sort of stepping in, you know. I've heard it referred to sort of you know, anti-racist self-help. that can be a pretty big issue. One, because the work itself could just be co-opted as, I don't know, a way to feel good about oneself or some ownership. And I think what I'm seeing, and thankfully what I'm seeing, is that a lot of Black and Brown folks are getting a stage and a microphone where they weren't before. And they're getting to say what they really think and feel, and people are actually listening. And yet we're still really early days in that. And so I'm excited to see where things go, but you can just see the backlash, right? I mean,
Right.
You know, number 45 is the perfect embodiment of all the backlash to thinking reasonably and rationally, and very weirdly, things like masks and vaccines fall right in lockstep with that sort of, I don't even want to call it a fantasy world, because it's a very weird world to live in, where the up is down and down is up and truth doesn't matter.
And I was gonna say, it's not fantasy, because it has some very real impacts on society at large, for sure. I mean, we're seeing that right now. You mentioned performative anti-racism, these performative demonstrations. Do you think that Portland is at risk of seeing that maybe more than other communities, given that it is still largely white? How does a city that does not have a very large minority population navigate allyship in a way that is actually helpful and productive?
Yeah, well, this is a challenging question. I think it's important for... It's tough because I love my city for showing up and protesting for the, I don't know how many nights, right? 90 nights in a row or something like that.
Right.
100 plus. I think that's beautiful. That's wonderful. That is a mark of how deeply this city cares. And yet the way that can get played out is like, you know, just the throwing a bottle through the window is not the same as standing up in solidarity for the value of a Black life. And in that way, protest is always complicated. And it's why Dr. King had so much rigor around nonviolent protest and a strategy and approach there to make it as effective as possible. That being said, there's a remedy. And the remedy is really simple, is that when it's about racial justice and when it is about Black lives mattering, putting Black lives to the forefront and putting Black voices to the forefront of that movement is so important. That does not mean that allies and white voices have no place and no voice and should not show up. That's not what it's meant to mean at all. It just means that let us speak for ourselves. That's it, right? And that's the start of a remedy. Look, I'm not an activist. I'm not an organizer. But when white individuals are attempting to speak for Black individuals and speaking instead of, it starts to become really problematic, because then it does become performative, and then it becomes actually massively detrimental, because then you're stealing the oxygen in the space simply because of that ability and that privilege to sort of take up that space. And so to do a thing that's very hard to do, which is just to step back and leave that space open. That might mean that some other white person steps into it, but at least it wasn't you who stepped in that space and took up that space, right? And that's panels, that's protests, that's positions of power. I mean, you name it. Letting Black voices and Black individuals have that stage, I think, is massively important.
Well, obviously, I know this is a conversation that has to continue on so many levels. And I think that's probably one of the reasons that we're seeing your company see continued success and expansion. So what started as this book for your kids has now grown into a kids company about. So tell us a little bit about the expansion here of this company and kind of all of the ways in which you are now helping to expand and continue these conversations.
It's really simple. If I don't tell these stories, who will? If I don't lead a company, you know, now we're 25 folks and grow it, who's going to go out and tell these stories? And I think the reality is I'm not sure anybody can or will. Traditionally, there's no money in this space. Traditionally, it's very easy to get it wrong. And then traditionally, you know, most of the CEOs in this space, they're dudes and they're white, and they don't come with the experience or the know-how to tackle these things, nor with this sort of... and just to go back to my story, the sort of entrepreneurial fearlessness, like the background to take the risk, right? Media companies are...
It's got to get focus grouped first.
Exactly. And so so that's part of the reason why. The second reason why is it's just about damn time that we have diverse voices telling their own stories. Not just diverse characters and diverse stories, but having diverse individuals tell those stories, especially when it comes to kids' media. It is highly male, it is highly white, and all of it is all about, you know, cuddly teddy bears and, you know, kung fu pandas and dragons and princesses and, you know, messages of it's going to all be all right all the time if you only can find the cape or the crown or the whatever, right? And that's fine. Mm-hmm. And entertainment has its place, but kids live in reality and they experience reality. And who's going to talk to them about that? So we've expanded into telling more stories through more formats. Now it's not just kids' books, it's board books. We have 7 podcasts with 3 more on the way just this year alone, all distinct different shows: climate change, facts, current events, words, activism. And then, you know, our most recent entrant from a product perspective is a streaming platform, an education streaming platform designed for kids 10 to 15, centered around big ideas, life skills, and careers. And the core idea is like, who is talking to our teens today? Who's making things for them? I can tell you, it is just a handful of places, and they are all not places built for that age group. They are social media. That's Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, YouTube. Turns out none of those things were built with teenagers in mind at all. They are either highly entertaining or meant to sort of, you know, spill upon them the advertising industrial complex to sell them all sorts of things, even if they have no expendable income. They're products made for adults. And so for us, we just thought, you know, that group of individuals, I have 3 teenagers, by the way, they just want to be respected. That's it. They just want some respect. And so our classes really offer them a respect of going, here's what it's like to discover your passion. Here's what it's like to live with authenticity. Here's what it's like to embrace courage, right? These really wonderful life skills. And then when it comes to their futures, we go, here's what it's like to be a musician. Here's what it's like to be an architect. And then topics that just do not get discussed with teenagers, but totally should. Topics like mental health or optimism, right? For them to tackle their inner lives in a meaningful way and not play lowest common denominator where we're talking to the 7-year-old in the room, but no, we're going to talk to them like they can handle it, like they're smart, and we're going to bring really great production value to that. So, so excited about our class platform, A Kids Class About, so excited about our podcast network, A Kids Podcast About, and then still really excited about our book publishing platform, A Kids Book About, because they're all bringing diverse voices to the fore. They're all telling really challenging, empowering, and important stories. And my hope is that we're playing the long game, is that we're making media that really matters for kids so that 30 years from now, when they're raising their own kids, they're raising them on these stories, but not just these stories, on who they become or became because of these stories.
As a millennial with you know, with anxiety and depression, and who grew up in, you know, very much a we don't always have to talk about some of this stuff environment. Mm-hmm. These are so many of the conversations that, yeah, I wish I had heard or been a part of more when I was younger. I wonder what the long-term impact of that would be. And I'm excited to see that for this younger generation and what it leads to. I'm just curious, you know, as someone who obviously like also didn't grow up in that environment of having these conversations, of getting into some of these higher level topics, like what has made you want to break that mold and to break that cycle and have those conversations?
I think the words you just use put it very well, which is to break that cycle. It really is a cycle. And having grown up fatherless, having grown up with neglect, with trauma, with abuse, was how do I break that cycle for my own kids and not just phone it in? And I think there's a whole host of parents, a generation of parents who want to break the cycle, right, with their own children. And it is really about breaking a cycle of all those things. And I think it starts with just talking to your kids, opening up these doors to have these conversations. You know, I think about the years of therapy that I've gone through that could have been solved with a conversation. It could have been solved with a hug and a conversation when I was a kid. And so if we can enable that, I mean, you know, it's what I go through every day as a dad, trying to do my best job and realizing I'm totally failing at it, but still trying to do a good job of going, I have to give my kids better than I had. you know, because they deserve it. And I know the effects very intimately that it had on me having the childhood that I did. And so it becomes fuel for me. You know, the why is I think I'm able to because I understand the stakes. I understand the impact that it had on me. And so, you know, trying to give my kids different, but also, you know, can I contribute to giving a generation of kids something different?
I think your children and countless other children are very, very lucky, I think, to be having these conversations and being in an environment where all of this is something that is on the table. I just think that's hugely important. Well, Jelani, I know you are a very busy guy, so I appreciate you taking time to talk with me today. Is there anything else that I didn't ask you about that you want to add before I let you go?
No, it's a wonderful discussion and so appreciative that you had me on. I think the next generation deserves better. And I'm just as a dad and an entrepreneur trying to do my part to make it happen.
Portland is lucky to have you and to keep you around. I'll say that. Thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I don't know how Christmas was around your house, but there was this time as I was in the 11, 12, 13 range that I started to get these gifts that I wanted, or I was very appreciative of, and I found to be interested in, but turned out that it was something my parents could use too. And I find it interesting that toward the end of this conversation with Jelani, you hear how the intention was to write this book to help teach kids about difficult things. And it turns out he's teaching parents about difficult things because, as we were talking off the top, they never had these conversations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably really eye-opening too for adults, you know, to realize once you have that tool and you want to have some of these conversations, to maybe realize how uncomfortable or difficult it is for you to have those conversations and, you know, the areas in which you also could do a little more work, right? I think it's probably ending up being beneficial on both ends. And I think we really have, as a society, kind of gotten to a point at which a lot more of this stuff is on the table. And we're realizing that the problems that can arise from not talking about it are bigger than the problems that can arise from talking about it.
What do you find to be the most impressive about what Jelani has been able to accomplish so far?
I just think it's so impressive that he has the courage to take the ideas that he has and push them out into the open and think, you know, this could be beneficial to somebody else. I wonder how many times so many of us think like, oh gosh, you know, it'd be really helpful if I had something to do X, Y, Z. But how many of us don't ever act on it, right? And take that risk. I mean, as he said, he feels like he's a born entrepreneur. I don't know that I would have the courage to take an idea and put it out there into the world, potentially to fail, but to see if this would be something that other people could also benefit from, because I see a benefit to it. I just think it's so cool that he has the bravery and the willingness to go out and approach some of these things and find a way that works for him and his family, and clearly is having a benefit for so many other families too.
It's really inspiring.
It really is. It goes back to, you know, my thought about the problems from not talking about these things are bigger than the problems from talking about them. And I just think it's not easy to do. It's not easy to put yourself out there to open up that vulnerable part of yourself. But when you do, you can help facilitate a lot of these conversations and realize that, you know, there is ultimately a lot of good that can come out of it. So I just think it's great that he's made that his focus in life, that this is his, you know, his current and biggest entrepreneurial venture. It's just doing a lot of good.
Emily, for those people who have listened to this and would like more information about what Jelani's got going, what he's doing, how do they find it?
Yeah, so he's taken this idea, a kid's book about, and has recently, you know, rolled it into this whole company. So they're now a kid's company about. You can find them at akidsco.com. So akidsco.com. And that's where you can find all of the books that they published to date, new podcasts that they're working on, classes that Jelani mentioned for some older kids too, as they get into other topics and you want to spark that curiosity and continue conversations. All of it there at akidsco.com.
And of course, we will post a link to that in the article accompanying this podcast on coin.com as well. Yeah. Emily, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ian. Have a good weekend.
All right. So you're off this weekend on a trip to Maryland. And on my end, we're going to go camping. And then after the camping trip, I will be working hard with morning meteorologist Kelly Barron to finish up our climate change piece. And Labor Day weekend's next weekend. So this is the last time we're going to drop a six questions for a couple of weeks.
Right. Taking just a little break here at the end of the summer. Because we know that both of us have some projects to wrap up, some exciting things ahead, some changes at Coin6 News that will be soon to come. And of course, we know everybody else is busy squeezing out the very last drops of their Portland summer and sunshine as well. But we'll definitely be back with some fresh, fun Six Questions content in just a few weeks as we look ahead to the fall.
We'll talk to you on September 10th.
See you then.
Thank you for listening to Six Questions on the Coin Podcast Network. You can find our entire podcast library available on demand on coin.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. The Coin6 weather team has the most accurate forecast in town, certified by WeatherRate. Coin6 Weather, watching out for you.
You can hear all the trees falling. You can see the fire just consume the whole area.
Extreme weather in the Pacific Northwest is making headline news around the world. Fire.
It continues to threaten thousands of buildings and has already taken at least 4 lives.
Ice.
Well, the ice and snow brought down power lines. Over 90,000 customers are still without power.
Heat.
63 deaths can likely be attributed to that heat wave statewide.
I think Mother Nature is very mad at humans.
As unprecedented extreme weather events capture our attention,
the Coin Podcast Network is going beyond the headlines,
deep into a discussion about our changing climate.
Climate change is going to accelerate shifts that have always occurred.
The danger it poses to our future.
And the opportunities available if we choose to address it before it is too late.
Humans are really good at turning even tragedy into a profit-making opportunity.
People are just not prepared for this.
It is a climate in crisis, coming this September on the Coin Podcast Network.